Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
In 2006, Kerner Optical split from ILM. This week, we're going to reunite them in a two-part podcast. Terminator Salvation. Hi, I'm Mike Seymour, and I wanted to try something a little different this week. We're going to try and vary our format a little, going in-depth on two sides of effects, both cutting-edge digital and equally cutting-edge practical effects. Now, I should warn you, if you haven't seen the film Terminator Salvation, you really need to turn the podcast off now, because we're kind of packed with spoilers this week. You shouldn't view this as a comprehensive guide to all of the work done by either ILM or Kerner Optical, but rather than give you the sort of overview 10,000 feet view, we thought we'd try and get in there and ask very particular, very specific questions about these shots to kind of illuminate the overall picture. In fact, it's a trend that we've been trying to do lately at FX Guide, from FX Guide TV to now in the FX podcast, and we hope you enjoy it.
This is John Connor. If you're listening to this, you are the Resistance.
In part one of this podcast, I'm going to talk to Ben Snow at ILM, who led ILM's team as the VFX supervisor. Now, if you've seen the film, you'll know that there's a rather surprising sort of twist in the final act when a naked Arnold Schwarzenegger, a young, digital, naked Arnold Schwarzenegger, makes an appearance. And I asked Ben, right off the bat, how did ILM approach doing this, and how did they produce a 1984 digital version of California's governor?
Yeah, it was one of those things that kind of evolved a little bit. In the original script and the storyboards that we first got for the film, it was sort of very suggestive and shadowy, and you sort of a glimmer of eyes in a dark room. And so then we're like, well, you know, Charlie Gibson, the studio side effects soup, and McGee were like, well, you know, how far do we think we can push this and so on? And we're like, well, you know, we're pretty confident about it. And then McGee went to Comic-Con, and there was a huge reaction to first presentations on Terminator there. And he came back from it saying, well, you know what, this is something that we kind of really want to see, the audience really wants to see. But it was in doubt almost up until the very last minute. So we actually, in fact, did it two ways, one with the Schwarzenegger's representation and one without.
In fact, in the film's mythology, he actually, of course, looks slightly different between Terminator 1, Terminator 2, and 3. It felt to me in the viewing of it, just in the cinema, that it was a kind of a T2 Arnold Schwarzenegger, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, actually, no, we were really going for the T1 for the 1984, yes. And in fact, he, like his hairstyle and everything else, he doesn't have the short-cropped hair, which... In the first Terminator film, he starts out with sort of longish hair, more like Schwarzenegger in some of his 70s films. Right. So it's a very 70s, early 80s hairstyle. And then he gets burnt, if you recall. And then his hair is this sort of ratty-looking, short-cropped hairstyle. But then, from then on, the sort of image of Schwarzenegger is this sort of crew-cut, sort of square-headed sort of look. But our Terminator, our T-800, has to be before all of that. So the idea was to make it as the Terminator appears at the beginning of the Terminator.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yep. So how did you go about doing that? I mean, literally, how did you? What was the sort of the process? Given that I presume, being the governor of California and very busy with serious economic matters, he wasn't particularly involved in close production.
Yes. It was basically we started with a couple of things. Stan Winston Studios, which have now become Legacy Effects, were working on the film, providing some Terminator puppets for the Hydrobot and the T-800, which is the older sort of endoskeleton Terminator in the film, and then some practical stuff, masks and so forth for the T-800 human form. And so they had in their possession a cast that they made of Arnold Schwarzenegger for the first Terminator film. Now, technology in those days for casting people even was not quite where it was today. And so they had that cast, and they'd done a bit of reworking of it, and it was cast with the eyes shut and the mouth open. But we were able to get that cast off them and scan it, And then there's some photographs that we got from his different movies at the time and some photographs that they gave us from him at the time. And we were able to use that and that original scan, and then Gio Nakpil, our modeler, was able to basically sculpt our version of the Terminator as it appears in the film. And it was actually a really involved process because the scan, you know, there's certain things that happen when you do a cast of someone, particularly with the older technologies. These days we tend to cyber scan people even for makeup effects, but back then you would put alginate and so forth on their head and plaster, and so that actually has a weight that presses in there faces, so you get some certain areas that become puffy and certain other areas where bones are defined.
Yeah, it really actually changes the face, doesn't it? The actual process of doing it can actually dramatically affect, in the old days, the cast itself.
Yes, absolutely, and that's why people tend to do cyber scanning a little more these days, although, you know, that has its own issues as well. So, yeah, there was that change in the facial structure that comes from the casting process. And then what was interesting to us was that because the casting wasn't that detailed in those days, they would add pore detail later. So we also found when we got the high-resolution scan of this thing that there was some hand-added pore detail. And what was interesting is for a makeup purpose, that's really fine. But for extreme close-up digital application like what we were going to do, the human intervention of that and the pore detail being repetitive the way it would be if you sort of used, did it by hand, that actually was problematic for us. So, you know, obviously if Winston were then going to make a final sort of sculpture of him, they would have been able to fix all that up. But because it was really just being used for our purposes as the basis for a digital model, that was stuff that we had to go in and essentially replace. What we did was take a high-resolution scan of a real person, and we were able to get the sort of pore detail off of that.
And so what age was that sample skin from? I mean, what age was the...
You mean the Schwarzenegger?
The stand-in. The stand-in person
was about the same age. So, interestingly, Arnold Schwarzenegger was around in his late 30s when he did the first Terminator film. Although, God, he looks, you know, 10 years younger for sure. He was in such great shape. But, we used someone of a little younger, maybe mid-30s, and also then did what we needed to do based on looking at all of the material, photographic and film, that we had of...
I was going to say, because as you're sort of pointing out, the current trend in terms of image scanning and sort of SIDGRAPH papers is that kind of micropore level of detail that you just wouldn't have had.
Absolutely. In fact, I'd done... one of the things I was involved in a couple of years ago, just before doing Iron Man, was an internal project here at ILM we called Dark Garden, the purposes of which were to... look at our facial motion capture retargeting tools, look at the sort of underlying facial structure that we felt we'd need to create to be driven by facial motion capture and make it easy to remap was our goal, remapping a human performance onto something that's radically different. And at the same time, we were looking into making our skin shaders that had been essentially being developed for years here at ILM. Christoph Harry and others had done a lot of interesting work in skin shaders, and we were looking at how can we make that stuff more realistic, and that's where we really got into the micro pore detail and that sort of stuff. The creature we were doing was a sort of old lady and a witch character, actually very old and sort of somewhat caricatured, but we were trying to make her look as realistic as we could for our test purposes. So we got into a lot of the pore detail, and so a lot of the team on here, myself and Gio Nakpil, had sort of come into this with the background of that. So we were delighted to get this cast from Winston's, which we thought had all the pore detail, and it was just the double-edged sword of the fact that some of that pore detail had been added by humans that then took us away from some of the science, I suppose.
So was there a lot of height difference between Arnold Schwarzenegger? Because I imagine he's actually shorter than a T-800. The T-600s, I know, are meant to be 8 foot tall, but the T-800s are like, what, 6 foot tall? Or was there not much difference?
You know what? It isn't. The T-600s are a lot taller. They were supposed to be really big and clunky. And the idea was that they were the sort of somewhat pathetic attempt of Skynet to create a machine that would fool humans, but it was really badly done and sort of, you know, not even entering the uncanny valley, I suppose. So that was sort of the idea. It doesn't come across so clearly in the film, but that was the premise. And then the T-800, well, actually wasn't that different from Schwarzenegger. And Roland Kickinger, who portrayed the body of the T-800 for the film, was actually about the same size. In fact, he played Schwarzenegger in a documentary, a biopic of Schwarzenegger that was made for television several years ago. So he looks a bit like him as well. And, of course, he's muscular as well. Although, you know, we came to know Schwarzenegger's body pretty well as his face. And he was very, you know, he'd just sort of come out of his bodybuilding years. And his body was really pretty perfect.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. In terms of, you know, an actor portraying a role, he was the perfect choice because he was, you know, Mr. Universe, whatever he was, about 10 years in a row. But that was only part of the work that ILM did. And I guess in the range of the work that you did, it must have been an interesting balance, because was that the basis of the sort of what I'd call subsurface scattering type work? Because a lot of the other stuff would seem to be more rigid body or incorporating live action second unit.
Yeah, that's right. You know, all of the Terminators and that sort of thing were using different shading technology. The skin stuff, we called it the T8 skin internally, just for security purposes, because it was, you know, if it didn't make it in, we wanted to deny that it ever existed, I suppose. Oh, the studio wanted to. The skin stuff was using a bunch of the subsurface stuff that Christoph Harry had been developing over the years, and Pat Myers had done some interesting TD work on developing new shaders. So our view painter, Greg Jonkaitis, was essentially working. It was interesting because you really had to work as a team, doing this sort of high-end digital double type stuff, which is really what this was. The modeler and the view painter and the look development person who created the materials had to work really closely with the with each other, and then the modeler and the animator had to work very closely, because we weren't able to do facial motion capture for this. You know, it wasn't something where, even though Roland's looked like Arnold, you know, his performance was what they were after. What they were after was Arnold's performance in the original Terminator films. So we actually got the Blu-ray of Terminator 1 and sort of scoured through it, and I tried to find footage for each of the acting beats in Terminator Salvation that was most like what he'd done in the original Terminator film, and we started with that as our sort of goal. That was what we were trying to animate and do the shapes to. And we found it was very easy to drift off.
I was going to say, Lord only knows I'm no expert in bodybuilding, but I think I read somewhere that bodybuilding is very much a sort of a striking a pose and holding it kind of, which meant that he actually was quite good at producing a sort of robotic-esque movement.
He was, but what's really funny is studying it to the nth degree, he was actually very expressive in the Terminator films. When he's in the one of our main sources of reference was the club, and when he's in the club, Tech Noir, he really forms some interesting faces as he's firing at them and that sort of thing. And in fact, it's really we felt that it was sort of part of the character. You know, that was sort of some of what was making, as we were sort of struggling to say, what is it that makes him, that was sort of some of the stuff we were looking at. But when we sort of pitched this to McGee and to Charlie, they really, and I think rightly so, were looking at, the audience is looking for the impression of the Terminator that we think of, and it's a really impassive sort of, as you said, robotic impression. So even though the actor, and part of the thing that, you know, part of the essence of what makes the actor who he is, was a little more expressive than you remember, the image that you have of it is of a fairly passive and robotic sort of performance. So, yeah, it was it's interesting. We learn a lot about, you know, what makes someone human, the digital double process. And it was interesting because we weren't so heavily working off of scans, but there was a big aesthetic component to it. So even the way that the modeler and the painter are looking at things, and the modeler might look at a shadow as a part of his, you know, bone structure, and the painter might look at his shadow as part of his skin pigment. And so when you added the model and the paint together, it didn't look like him at all, even though the grey-shaded model looked like him a lot. When you added the paint, it stopped looking like him, and we were like, oh my God, what are we doing here? And we had to look at ways of making it possible for the modeler to be looking at the painted surface as we were sculpting, and have the painter not paint in. You know, we always try and make sure that the painter's not painting in any shadows or anything that could be shadows, and we use flat photography of the real characters to do that. But our best references in this case were not, you know, shot on a light stage with de Bevig type stuff, because it didn't exist for that particular person. Mm. Our best references were from movies and stills taken from the day, and they all had the shadows. So there was a whole round of subjectivity that we had to almost extract out of the process to try and arrive at something that really was a good likeness.
Which, of course, would all be relevant looking forward if someone tried to get you, for example, to make a JFK for a JFK film or something, where you wouldn't have, I guess, the advantage. You'd go too far back.
No, exactly. This was more like one of those things where if you were trying to make someone from when they were younger or a historical figure, all of that would very much apply. But, you know, it's a little different from the Benjamin Button situation where, you know, you can drive it from the actor and so forth.
Tell me, was it really then head replacement? I mean, were there any full body replacements?
I don't think there was a shot where we didn't touch the body, certainly not in terms of what's in the film. And probably, in retrospect, we could have done even more. We certainly did some really good flesh over bone type testing and stuff. Originally, that wasn't the brief, but as the film progresses, this is a bit of a spoiler, but as the film progresses, he, you know, fairly quickly, actually, after appearing, gets blasted down to essentially the endoskeleton. Mm. So there are those hybrid shots where we have him, you know, mostly a man, but you know, his face and his body are being blasted apart and his flesh is sort of hanging off. Now, for ratings purposes, you don't see maybe as many of those shots as we did, but for those purposes, we did need all the flesh working. So in this film, we didn't actually go further, but certainly we could have, and maybe in retrospect, you know, because of the differences between their bodies and because we ended up doing a lot of touch-up on the real performer's body, to make it more flawless, like the original actor was, you know, it's something that maybe we could have done more aggressively, I suppose.
So we touched on earlier that there was a lot of other sort of work done, and I'm interested also in the fact that there was quite a bit of miniatures and stuff done for explosions and some of the really great action pieces. How did you determine the mix between digital and practical? And I know you supervised a bunch of stuff down at Kerner.
You know, I've done a lot of work with Kerner Optical when they were part of ILM, and Charlie Gibson, who was on the studio side, also has done a lot of work with them on the Pirates films, which he was working on as the studio side supervisor. So we have a good familiarity with them, but Charlie and I would basically talk about what is the best approach for a given shot. We were actually keen to try some miniature plane explosions and that sort of thing. I'd done Pearl Harbor, which obviously had a lot of CG plane explosions, or combos where we actually did some full-size ones on that as well, but we also made CG plane explosions, but then shot miniature elements to track in. So we were kind of keen to do a more traditional approach, and then it was economics as well and capacity as well. So it was a combination of both things that sort of contributed to our discussions. Definitely where the buildings were involved and buildings break down, falling apart and breaking down, you know, they can do that stuff terrifically well. And essentially with those things, it became a conversation with Kerner Optical, the miniature company, on scale. You know, what can we do for the scale? So for the end of the film, the big destruction shots, we decided to you know, go with a couple of scales, one for a key building that we had to blow up, and then for wider shots, we'd shoot that key building in that scale, but also shoot a different scale for the expanse of Skynet as it gets hit by a shockwave. So, you know, it's and then we were able to combine that with a lot of CG explosion enhancements and that sort of thing. We did some really impressive explosions there that you sadly you don't see so well in the film. At the beginning of the film, there's an extremely elaborate shot where it's like 2 minutes long, where John Connor essentially runs out of a hole in the out of this bunker.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that shot to the helicopter, and then it continues around.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a really nice shot.
Yeah, it was really interesting to do.
And I loved how it finished upside down.
Yes, I know. Well, I mean, it was made out of about six different elements. I mean, the idea was, of course, you know, inspired by similar shots in, you know, War of the Worlds and Children of Men. And, you know, there's been a couple of examples over recent years. And obviously, you know, De Palma's been doing those sort of long shots for real for many years. In this case, of course, it was... You know, on Children of Men, I believe they were like planning and rehearsing some of those shots for like a week. But in this case, we were really shooting in all sorts of different places. So the shot with the helicopter and John Connor started in the middle of a field outside the studios in Albuquerque on this set that they'd built for the edge of a bunker that the resistance break into at the very beginning of the film. And he's climbing out of that. The camera comes up and we whip pan off of him onto something that we shot on the back lot of the studio where Mike Minardis, the special effects guy, had rigged a full-scale helicopter off a crane. So Christian Bale runs into that shot, this helicopter parked on like a sandy backdrop with blue screen behind, and climbs into the helicopter, finds the pilot's dead, gets in, takes off, the helicopter gets lifted off by the crane, and, you know, we've got the camera on a techno crane as the helicopter spins around. And then from that, we transition from that real helicopter briefly into a CG helicopter that's mainly used to help us transition into a different setup again, where Christian Bale is now in the gimbal of the inside of the helicopter. It's just, you know, a rig that's really just detailed for the inside. And the camera passes into the helicopter and gets into close-up on his face as he tries to control the helicopter as it's spinning out of control. And then from that, basically, as it spins out of control, it transitions again into an upside-down set piece as he crashes, essentially, the helicopter, where first a stuntman drops out of the seat, and then we transition back to Christian Bale lying on the ground upside down in the helicopter. And then the camera on this last piece crawls out with him. He looks over to where he sees the nuclear blast that sort of threw the helicopter off track. And we pan back, and then the T-600 grabs him. So it's, you know, several different shooting environments all sandwiched together using sort of the best of the match-moving reprojection technology that we call Zenviro, and then a little bit of the CG helicopter, and then we combine that with some miniature elements of these via communications satellite dishes and some digital versions of that, a big matte painting when he's up in the air, big CG dust effect, and some miniature elements of breaking up dishes that we catch a glimpse of, and then a combination of stills of the miniature and CG nuclear cloud, and then the CG T-600 that grabs Connor. So it's kind of a big,
very
big mismatch of elements.
Those transitions that you mentioned, you say are transitions to this shot. I mean, is that literally as simple as a painstaking morph this bit, matte this bit, you know, dissolve this bit, or is there...
Well, the first transition from the Christian Bale in the field to Christian Bale on the blue screen backlot set was a whip pan. So for that, though, of course, we needed to create one camera move in the computer that covered all of this. And so Jason Snell, our layout lead, basically spent quite some time marrying these things. And the irony was... they wanted to change lenses during some of this. So you're going from a 28 to a 21 because the 21 works better inside the thing. But they shot the first part of this, they shot it with a 28. And they're like, well, can we deal with that? And you're like, oh, my God. But for the transition, so the whip pan's not a problem, right? The main headache is for Jason because he has to transition his camera during the whip pan. Then when he climbs in and the thing flies around, at a certain point, Jason has to free the camera up so that he can tilt off of the helicopter, catch a glimpse of a dish breaking up, and then tilt back onto the helicopter. And then we're still on the practical helicopter for that portion, but then when we transition from the practical helicopter after the tail swings around past camera and we dive in through the doorway to get into our close-up on Christian Bale, then at that point we go CG briefly and reproject the original helicopter footage onto our CG model, and so the interior is coming from one of the plates and the exterior is coming from the other plates. And the whole transition from a 28mm to a 21mm gets buried during that digital reprojected transition. So that's where you get a very complex remapping and...
Presumably exposure issues as well, right?
Yes, which Mark Nettleton, the composer, had to sort of deal with on every one of these transitions. Plus then we add dust to try and help us out. But, you know, frankly, yeah, it's pretty unforgiving, and you're doing a digital morph, really, because you're reprojecting onto real 3G geometry. And then for the last thing, where he drops out of the helicopter, you know, where the helicopter crashes and he falls out, and we have to go from him miming the crash, which is still the right way up, we have to go from him to a stuntman who's upside down now on a completely different set piece, back to Christian Bale again, lying on the ground, in the upside-down helicopter set piece, then we use morphing and so forth.
Are you using Sabre to do the layout for that and then using, like, Shake or...
No, we do it all in our Zenviro, in our Xeno tool set. So, yeah. Okay. We didn't use Inferno at all on this. It was all done in Shake, actually. Nuke, I think.
And so on a sequence like that... which is pretty much a 2D problem as opposed to, as we were talking earlier with the Schwarzenegger problem, which is very heavily a 3D problem.
Yeah.
Is it better to have a small team for a really long time that can just, or is it better to, because if it's trying to be one continuous shot, I mean, how do you approach that in just in terms of staffing it?
We initially assigned one compositor to it, Mark Nettleton, who led the shot. So we actually started off, you know, one of the beautiful things about the ILM toolset is that it does blur the line between 2D and 3D because we can do reprojections through Zenviro so easily. Mm-hmm. So in that case, we had the layout guy doing the Jason doing the all of the initial part of the shot, and I was like, okay, I want a clean, good-looking shot transitioning between all these elements, even though there'll be rough edges that we render out of Xeno so we can see how this looks before we really get into the heavy compositing. Now, it wasn't really possible to do that. Maybe to milk, you know, to refine that as much as we ideally could have. But then we put it in the hands of the compositor. But, yeah, we ended up teaming other people on it. So in the end, someone was dealing with the beginning, someone was dealing with the middle, and someone was dealing with the end. You know, I don't know. I'd never done a shot like that before. None of us had. I don't know if shots like that have been done before that are so CG intensive. So I'm not sure if it was the best way to do it. I think that I'd probably spend longer in the layout, even longer in the layout time, you know, torturous though that was.
And another question for you on that, because it struck me that if you were doing that from an editorial point of view, you might be selecting a take based on this is the right pacing of the performance that I want. And if you're doing it from a transition between the position the stuntman finds himself in and the position Christian Bale starts in, that might dictate a different take. How much flexibility did you have on take selection, or was it a matter of going, well, we're much better take?
They gave us all the material and we were free to ask for stuff. In fact, at one point, I think we ended up shortening the shot. It's still quite long, but we actually chopped out a whole chunk in the middle. And in that case, we had to, essentially the tricky part was transitioning between Christian Bale with two different lighting schemes on him because the light, you know, we've got him on a gimbal and the light swung around. So we did have, certainly, you know, our relationship with Charlie was excellent and editorial, and we were able to suggest that. But I always say with that sort of stuff, cover yourself, like when you're shooting even, cover yourself in case you run into any technical brick walls, but go for the best performance and try and do everything you can to make that performance work. And, you know, sometimes there's a lot more roto or reprojection. Certainly these shots were, you know, went way beyond what we'd sort of expected them to in terms of the amount of effort they took. But, you know, we were able to stick with the performance they wanted.
At the end, you have this spectacular nuclear blast as the crew fly away in the chopper from the headquarters where they've left the detonator charges. And there's a large Kerner optical practical going on there.
At the end of the film, there was a very nice series of shots where Serena's tower, which is the big white tower in the film, explodes, and that was a miniature from Kerner Optical, actually two miniatures, one which was for the tower blowing up and its immediate surrounds, and then as we cut wide, we go to a smaller scale miniature for the shockwave taking out the city, and then as we cut super wide, that is combined. So those, the first three shots are using all Kerner Optical elements with a little bit of 2D enhance and so forth, and then the last shot in the sequence is basically a CG nuke. It's not the version that's in the trailer, which is actually something I believe they took from Terminator 3, it looks like. But in the film version, it's a nuke, like the one that we did for the end of the beginning. Oh, the other thing we should maybe talk about a little bit, I don't know if this... You know, when Connor gets grabbed by the T-600... That robot, of course, was built as a Stan Winston practical puppet. And, you know, there's a few shots in the film that use the puppet. Most of the stuff in that opening scene is the CG, although there's one or two shots where we might have just replaced the head or the arm of it. But we actually developed a new lighting approach, or used a new lighting approach for the first time on this, that really took some of the stuff we did on Iron Man, but took it even further, because we... implemented energy-conserving shaders in RenderMan and used a more image-based approach even than Iron Man, partly because, it was partly because we knew there was going to be this extremely harsh DI treatment that they were going to do that super contrasted it out. And so we wanted to really more correctly be capturing the dynamic range of what the real photography aid, because it's a, you know, we're shooting in a desert environment and then in a factory where explosions and sparks and all that sort of crap are going off. So you've got some pretty extreme contrast. So for that, we sort of came up with some new lighting tools, one of which was a important sampled energy-conserving image-based lighting approach that really meant that we were able to capture the dynamic range. So when we had a light source like the sun and a high dynamic range image where we'd captured the sun, we were able to more physically correctly capture, you know, render the dynamic range that the original photography would have had.
So let me just back up there for a second, just to set the scene. So yeah, we're talking about the T-600 grabbing him at the end of the helicopter sequence, when, of course, he ends up blasting it and they fight, yeah. And in that sequence, you were shooting exterior for the plate photography?
We were shooting exterior, all on location in Albuquerque, and upside-down helicopter set.
Okay, and the extreme grade you're talking about is the fact that it would be effectively a bleach bypass look, story-wise, because there'd been a nuclear holocaust, it seemed a justifiable path to take for the filmmakers.
And so,
your approach was to still take, presumably, was it fisheye-based or a scanner-based HDR set measurements? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So basically, our approach to that, as we did with Iron Man, but we did we bracketed more extremely on this, so to get a higher dynamic range than we were able to on that film. So we took high dynamic range images by bracketing exposures on our digital camera, and then we had a new shader set that we developed on the film that was energy conserving, so that if you had a light of a certain intensity, the material would reflect back more correctly that intensity, and use the image-based lighting a little more, correct. You know, I guess we were a little more physically correct, perhaps, than we you know, had traditionally been with our renderings. So that meant that what we got out of the renderer was more correctly modeling what would happen if we actually, as we did do, shot the Winston puppet out in this harsh, really contrasty environment.
So was that an innovation coming from better use of the shaders, or was it actually an extension to the RenderMan to allow for the image
it conservation? It was an extension. Christoph Harry and Simon Prezot and, Pat Conran and people on our show, basically there was new code that they wrote for the shaders to allow us to do this. The render times went up, I'll say that. But I have to say I'm pretty happy with the results. It wasn't used for the whole film, but it was certainly used for that and for the T600 stuff, T800 stuff at the end, and for the dogfight, the aerial chase through the canyons and stuff like that.
I commented at the time that I thought the work on Iron Man was seamless in terms of the integration of the metallic hard surfaces, though they were painted, of course. There's a Pitner, a kind of a different aging property we're seeing on the Terminators in this film than we saw in the early ones, where they're more sort of shiny and perky.
Mm-hmm.
Did that play at all in this, or was this more to do with the fact that it was in the harsh, extreme sun environment?
What was driving it was the fact that, we were certainly proud of what we'd achieved with Iron Man, but we definitely, as a company, said, okay, you know what, we still think we can do better. What else can we do to make this work? And Terminator was a good project to explore that on, because we had this really, the combination of the harsh lighting environments, the exterior desert and the interior very dynamic factory environment, plus we had the...
Is this an extension?
We had the extreme lighting environments, plus we had the need to be able to give the filmmakers the flexibility during the digital intermediate to really pull around this image.
Right.
And, not have the high-end depart when they contrasted it up, or the low-end depart when they were, flashing things. So it was, the usual problem we always have in CG of getting the black levels right, but it was sort of exacerbated by this contrasty look.
So presumably you must have some kind of LUT that was previewing what you expected them to go
That's
towards.
That's exactly what we did. So we worked in a neutral space as well,
yep.
And then in addition we created what we called the DI proxy, the digital intermediate proxy LUT, which was way contrastier. Ironically, it still wasn't anywhere near as extreme as what they used for the film. So, of course, when I'm looking at shots here, they're pretty damn colourful and stuff, and in the film there's like nothing there. But they're even, they're super contrasty as well.
Just in technology terms, is there a continuum between Iron Man 1, the Terminator metallic sort of solutions, and then work that you might be doing in Iron Man 2? Is that like a, or are they side research projects? Does this all sort of fall in the same?
No, actually, I'm definitely, as I leveraged some of the new specular functions that we came up with for the Iron Man when I did Terminator, we'll be able to leverage some of these new lighting tools when we do Iron Man 2. But, we're sort of not giving up either. We'll continue to try and improve it and look for new ways to make it look even better.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I loved the film, actually. I thought it was really good. It was a good ride.
It's a good ride, isn't it?
Yeah,
totally.
And again, terrific work on the visual effects, and it was a great treat for me, actually, because I didn't know going in that I was going to see a digital Schwarzenegger, so I enjoyed seeing your solution to that.
That's really good. And, I think it's good the way they did it, and it definitely... It's a good moment. It's short. It's a little short. I mean, I wish there was a couple more, like, close-ups or something later on. But it definitely, I don't know, it does the job, doesn't it? You really, you feel like, oh, that's nice.
It's almost paying respect to the franchise rather than sort of negating it, if that makes sense.
Exactly, yeah. And I like the way they did it, too. It actually really supported it, the way they sort of had the music and the audience. Just seeing it with an audience was a blast, because you just got this sort of, like, the energy just went up at that moment in a cool way.
What's funny, is that the character in the plot is evil. He's trying to kill the hero. It's a dramatic reveal, and all that happened in our audience was a sympathetic laugh, smile, cheer. Do you know what I mean? It was like the audience wasn't...
That's an interesting point, actually. Yeah,
there was like a joyous reaction to what they were seeing on the screen, even though this kind of pretty much meant bad stuff for everybody that we cared about in the film.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting observation. I don't know.
Well, I think we just like him, right? We like the whole franchise. We like the... it was, you know...
Yeah.
It was iconic. Thanks again so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
No worries.
And now part two of the podcast, where we turn our attention to Koerner Optical and look at the amazing miniatures work they did. Again, we're going to focus on just two shots, the large area array and the explosion of Serena's tower at the end. One is a large-scale miniature that it collapses without pyrotechnics, and one is probably some of the greatest pyrotechnics we've seen on screen, certainly this year. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Now, we're getting you sort of post-operatively. You've literally sort of been through the wars yourself, so to speak, as my father used to say. Are you okay?
Yes, I am fine. Thank you for asking.
So,
I'm doing well.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. Well, we'll try not to tax you too much, but I wanted to say congratulations on the film and the work that you guys have done. It's some really amazing work, and it's very sort of classic. As a fan of special effects and visual effects myself, it's a sort of classic stuff we like seeing, you know, really good, high-quality blowing stuff up. It's terrific work. You must have really enjoyed getting a chance to do some of this work at the facility.
We absolutely enjoyed it. It was a tremendous pleasure working with Charlie. You know, in the beginning, we went down and had a meeting with Charlie. He showed us some of the previs leading up to us being awarded the contract for this show. And I remember thinking at the time, "Oh God, please! I really want to do this. It's some of your, you know, classic moments. You know, blowing up A-10s and crumbling buildings and, you know, lots of violent nuclear shockwaves and things like that. We really enjoyed doing that type of work, and it was really exciting to be a part of it.
I want to start, if I can, with the in the opening sequence when the satellite dishes for the insurgents attack into the lab, and the there is some shots of satellite dishes. What sort of scale were they operating at? Because I presume it was sort of not as big as you would normally operate.
Well, we built that scene was rather interestingly done. We actually used two different scales. For the, we called them VLAs, very large array, and they were to match, you know, something that was not unlike what was going on near the location that they actually shot the film, New Mexico. We did the very large arrays at 12th scale, and we also did them at 32nd scale, okay? And the way that it was conceived of by Charlie and Ben to create that scene, because it's one big, long camera move that continues on for quite some time, that when the bunker buster event hits and sends out this tremendous shock wave, one of the shock elements that we provided was the ground effects shock wave, so the dirt rippling coming right at camera, followed by the VLAs basically crumbling, you know, by the force of the energy that's hitting them and basically pulling them into the earth. So we built those at 12th scale, the big ones, which were about 6 feet in diameter, the dishes. And we rigged them individually on small decks that were actually only about maybe 12 or 13 feet by 12 or 13 feet. And they were rigged to actually be, there were some pyrotechnics involved, but in addition to that, they were yanked into the deck about as hard as you could possibly do it and shooting again at high speed. We shot those with multiple cameras looking at them from various different angles. Most of them were ground level, but, you know, sort of, you know, so many 45 degrees off of each other, and able to get three different elements from one VLA being destroyed. And we did that just exactly like that same technique, multiple times. So, in a sense, we created a library of VLA destruction. Charlie Gibson was out for that shoot, and he was, you know, really gracious and super, super great at directing, you know, the level of intensity that each one was experiencing. And it was as if some of them were getting hit, you know, directly with a super intense shock, and they were literally crumbling and crushing to the ground. And some of them, you know, may have had a little bit less action in order to create our library that would be able to be, you know, used at will by Ben Snow and ILM to create the environment. So at the end of that shoot, we basically handed off, you know, dozens and dozens of elements of these things being destroyed, giving them the freedom to composite them into the scene and time their destruction perfectly with the shockwave that was, you know, coming directly at camera.
I've got to say, the thing in looking at, and I've had the benefit of actually seeing the blue screen shots of those, the thing that struck me when I first saw them, it's not a very far distance to drop in the real world. I mean, I could drop something from, you know, 4 or 5 feet and it wouldn't shatter the way these do. And so it struck me that, now you've said it, the pulling of the cord is giving us a lot of that gravity force, but also there's a tremendous fracturing at a kind of micro level in the actual construction. And again, the thing that I would be concerned about, and obviously I'm not a model maker, is I'd build the darn thing and I'd yank the thing over and the whole dish would just pop off in one unit and sort of skid to the ground and just rock there.
Right.
To make it shatter like that, it looks like it must have been some kind of very carefully constructed sort of dish, because it's really got, that's what gives it its kind of scale, I guess, that micro fracturing. How did you do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting that you noticed that, and I appreciate that. It was a very large topic of discussion on our end. Because, in fact, as you say, you know, the biggest fear is that it pops off and it bounces off the ground and it doesn't do what we needed it to do. It's very challenging when you're constructing something like that because, first of all, the structure of it in by nature is very strong. It's a compound structure. It's got this massive trellis, aluminum trellis structure on the back. It's being held up by two, you know, very massive yokes. And so, you know, to build something like that that has the right weight and gravity and level of destruction as it comes down a very, very short distance without having it fall apart on us in transport, getting it from our shop over to the stage or anything like that. What we did was we built them, basically constructed them as you see them in the undamaged state. The entire back structure was all aluminum, and we did that so when they were yanked into the ground, that things would bend and twist and do what natural materials would do. The dish itself was a very, very thin fiberglass dish that we laid up all individually. And then as I was describing, to take that dish and connect it to that lattice structure in the back without having it all fall apart, it had to be done all together. And then when we got it out to stage and we got it in position, we basically relieved it within an inch of its life. So we went in with very fine little diamond cutters and all kinds of little cutting tools and razors and things like that. And we basically just cut it to the point to where it was hardly holding itself together. At the same time, Jeff Herron and our effects department went in and we choreographed, you know, we worked directly with him, found the exact pressure points that we needed to remain strong to be able to herk this thing in and not have the cables that are yanking it just rip, you know, a very small little section out of it and destroy the shot. So all of those areas were sort of kept intact and kept strengthened. The other areas were relieved and weakened to, you know, a really high level. And again, because we were creating a library, we were able to relieve some of them tremendously so that they, you know, as you see in the film, they're actually beginning to fall apart as they're coming into the ground. Hence us telling the story of the shockwave. It's not as if they're just getting knocked out from the knees. It's as if the shockwave is so tall atmospherically that it's beginning to blow those panels off and take this thing apart as it's coming down to the ground.
Because, I mean, the thing about it is, if there was a huge fireball, you'd go, well, it has to just sort of break apart and a bit of debris fly out, but then the fireball basically covers up. And not only does it cover up, it kind of just covers up and it kind of hides everything because everything gets blackened.
Right.
But what you've got is shots where I almost feel like I can see the rivets popping on the panels that hold the what I imagine to be vast panels together, though of course they must be, you know, inches across.
Yeah.
And not only that, but if it was, again, just like a matchstick kind of very balsa woody fine thing, it might look good standing still, but you still have to have enough structural integrity that you can attach a single line to it and yank it down really hard. And, of course, if you just yanked that one line and that one strut popped out, you're not getting anywhere. So it's actually kind of like not only the engineering of it, but the engineering to withstand the structural force of the tug.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what I, you know, basically just described, where we were able to maintain structural integrity in areas. We used, you know, the vertical forces. So, in other words, if you're pulling something straight down and your cable is attached at the top of the dish and you want to pull that structure down beyond zero, so the idea was, as we're pulling the structure down, to give it the tremendous weight that it does have in full scale, we actually pulled it, we continued to pull it into the ground. So I could describe it as if you had a tin can and you had a cable going through it, and the cable was attached to the top of the tin can, and you put this tin can on a platform and then you yanked the cable and actually crushed the tin can from the top down by using a cable on the inside. That's essentially what we did with the VLAs. At the same time, everything around that tin can and around that structural element that we were using to yank the thing down was relieved and weakened to the point to where, you know, as it's coming down and as it's being drug into the ground, it's falling apart as we do that. At the same time, the ground plane around the VLA was a very fine, super fine particulate. We use this material that's called Fuller's Earth. Mm-hmm. We very, very carefully laid in a very fine little layer of Fuller's Earth in the dirt on the deck, and also ever so lightly dusted it all over the VLA itself. So as that thing was being pulled into the ground, it's if the thing has been standing there for a long time and it's collected a lot of dust and dirt on it through, you know, somehow these things survive Judgment Day. You know, as that's happening, there's just this ever so fine little wisp of dust coming off of them, and as they're being ground into the ground, there's this sort of little dust roil that's happening on the ground level as well.
When you get to build something like this from outset, is this something that you design on a CAD system, or is this just the experience of the model maker in knowing how to build something like this?
Both. We don't do we don't do virtual simulations. I know it can be done, but it doesn't always tell you exactly what the materials are going to do. You know, a lot of that comes with instinct on our end. And, you know, the trellis system in the back of the VLA was definitely designed in CAD. And that enabled us to, you know, basically build the thing digitally. And then we were able to dissect the digital model. And then we had, it was basically like a giant Tinker Toy kit. At that point, we were able to construct the thing. All the parts were the same. So, you know, we needed, you know, 1,000, you know, of this length of this tube, you know, pinched on both ends with a hole drilled in it so it can be attached. And again, going around and creating this fantastic truss system that's around the back of the VLA. But most of that comes through our thinking it through. I mean, what you really need to do in a case like that is you need to imagine what it's going to do under those circumstances. And the questions that you're bringing up, how do you create this thing so it doesn't get ripped apart when the cable yanks? These are all questions we ask before we begin construction to ourselves. And once we think we've found the answers to it, then we'll build one or two. In the case of the VLAs, we built a couple that were designed for testing. We hand them off to Jeff Herron and his department, and we go ahead and yank one in and see what it does. And at that point, though, the faith that we have in our ability really has to has to be strong, because at that point, you've been around motion pictures long enough to know that at that point we're still not 12 weeks away from shooting. We're probably actually building these things based on theory, and we had we'll have a number of them already way far along in construction when we actually end up getting to do some of our first tests. So based on that information, we may go back and say, now we know we need to relieve it more, or oh my God, this thing just crushed like a piece of paper. We need to strengthen it. So
is part of that just a camera test in terms of what the director likes in terms of the speed of it, or is it really that you pick the camera speed based on the maths of the inverse of the?
The camera speed's chosen, based on scale, also based on the director's desire for this. Charlie Gibson absolutely wanted things to look like it was really happening. So it wasn't a situation where we were shooting, super slow motion on this stuff. It was all supposed to be very, very realistic. So the scale speed of the camera, then we may go ahead and up the speed just a little bit, to give it a little bit more scale and to give it a little bit more weight. Typically we'll do video tests, and then we will do a virtual video speed, and we can take a look at what it's doing and say, okay, we're happy with 48 frames or we're happy with 72 frames. And, we'll discuss it with Charlie. Often on this film, we would either do a video test or a film test at speed, and send it to Charlie if he thought we were shooting along the right frame rate lines. Then he would say, "Yeah, that looks great. That's exactly what we're looking for, and that's what we're doing." So,
and it's funny because people, I guess, imagine, well, why not just shoot it at a really, really super high frame rate, and you can always go down from there. But of course, then you'd get the shutter wrong, and you're probably already fighting the light levels because you obviously need lots of depth of field on these miniatures.
Yeah, we obviously have to shoot at really high frame rates, but the light levels are very challenging at super high frame rates. And if we can shoot at the right frame rate, that's preferred.
I have one major criticism of this film, which is just, I think, an outrage, which is that there's a shot of the Skynet being blown up at the end. They cut away to an interior of the helicopter halfway through the explosion. And I've got to tell you, I think that was just, if it's the wrong adjective, I apologize, but it was a gorgeous explosion.
And I was just, well, thank you.
I was so miserable that they cut away from it. I wanted to keep staying on the shot, which, of course, is the hallmark of a good shot. Tell me, the blowing up of the Skynet tower at the end, can you tell us how that was done? Because unlike the one we just described, this was both miniatures and pyrotechnics.
Absolutely. So for Skynet, we've created basically two Skynet compounds at two different scales. All right. The 24th scale Skynet compound was basically everything inside the crenellated wall. Okay, so you saw in the film when they arrived at Skynet, mm-hmm. they had to climb over this fortress-type wall to get to the tower that Serena's laboratory was housed in. And of course, this is the place that that it's all going to go down in the end of the film. So inside that wall, we created a compound that included the tower at 24 scale, which made the tower, about 23 or 24 feet tall. When the tower blows up, and we can get to the details of how we did all of that, but just to describe the second part of it, when the tower blows up and the camera moves to the wider angles, okay, what we're looking at is post-Judgment Day or post-nuclear San Francisco that is everything outside of that fortress wall, and that was all done at 48th scale. Okay, in that environment, that's where the extension of the nuclear blast is basically, leveling everything that's left in its path and traveling across the landscape and just destroying not only what is left of downtown San Francisco, but also, if you look carefully, you'll see there are some satellite Skynet compounds on the outside of that wall that are indicated by, sort of a futuristic architectural look in addition to some miniature lighting and things like that that give it some life and let you know that there's something going on there other than just post-apocalyptic downtown.
Yeah, and I know, and I should say that 48th scale has some just gorgeous kind of building shatterings.
Yeah.
And some really nice...
That was really cool. Jeff Herron and our team, led by Nick Dabo, really came up with some fantastic ideas for how to do that. It's important to note, Mike, that this entire, we just spent a lot of time talking about the VLAs. And with the VLAs, we had a lot of chances to get it right because, as I said, we created this library. With everything else on the film, including the exploding A-10s, the downtown Los Angeles crumbling building, a lot of the pyrotechnics that we did were all done, and particularly Serena's Tower and the Skynet compound and the surrounding downtown Los Angeles or downtown San Francisco, sequence, was all done in one take.
Wow.
It was much more cost effective, and some of these shots were so grand in scale that we did not have the luxury of building and or shooting two takes. So everything you see was done in one take with multiple cameras. And we, what we did was we, in the hero angle, the A camera angle, we stacked two cameras side by side. So if there was a negative failure or some sort of camera failure on the hero shot, we had two cameras backing it up. And then typically we would put two other cameras in other places, either panning or on some kind of a cable cam rig, flying across the sky or flying through one of our stages. So for Serena's, for the Skynet compound, it was a really big deal. It was a lot of work, and it was a lot of sort of theoretical design that we went through to achieve the look of the tower exploding and the leveling of everything beyond that, and we really only had one chance at it. So fortunately it was a total success.
But you had one chance at it, and if I had one chance at it, I'd say, well, for the love of whatever is holy, I'm not going to move the darn camera in case it's not exactly at the right position when the firing goes off. But this is made all the more spectacular is that tower is filmed with a camera that is flying past it and a kind of three-quarter high shot looking down, which presumably is a POV of the helicopter.
Isn't that a beautiful shot?
Oh my God, that is just magnificent. I mean, it really just is one of the nicest. And you know what? The way that the explosion kind of eats its way up the building. And the other thing that I love about that shot, and I don't know how you did it, but I'd love to hear, is you seem to have a really lovely color. It wasn't just like a white or just a kind of flash. There are bluey tones and orange tones. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, well, that was designed by Jeff Herron, our pyrotechnics director, and Charlie had described at one point that this is the future. It it's the machines. You know, they have a lot of technologies and things going on in this building, you know, with the manufacturing of the T-800s and, you know, all this stuff. That it's not just a typical place. This is not a fuel refinery blowing up. This is a very high tech environment. And if we can tell that story somehow by you know, shifting the color of the fire, shifting the color of the explosions, then you know that would be preferred. So Jeff came up with this magnificent compound that he was able to load into the mortar tree that we had going up through the center of this building that produced that magnificent blue fire. It just looks evil, you know. It feels evil. It's got a look to it that's, you know, unlike anything that we've really ever done, and I think that we've really ever seen before. And you know, in a miniature sort of skyscraper explosion. At the same time, the top of the building, the very top of the building, was Serena's laboratory, and where Marcus and Serena have their moment at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be able to really cap the thing off by having Serena's laboratory be this, you know, final gasp of ba-boom, you know, and separate itself from the rest of the building, which is basically the factory, right? So there were, you know, again, these beautiful compounds done, but in slightly different colors, as you said, using oranges and yellows. Really cap the thing off by having Serena's laboratory be this, you know, final gasp of ba-boom, you know, and separate itself from the rest of the building, which is basically the factory, right? So there were, you know, again, these beautiful compounds done, but in slightly different colors, as you said, using oranges and yellows and some blues and some sparks and things like that.
But it's like you've given a tonality that underscores the subplot based on the personality of an explosion. I mean, this is like a brief way beyond what I mean, you know, I knew it was a great shot, but this is really thoughtful pyrotechnics. I'm kind of lost for words, really.
It was really thoughtful pyrotechnics. The whole entire design of the shot, we really had an opportunity to shape the look of that environment through our work. You know, I had a conversation with Ben Snow around Christmas time, and we were blowing up Blair's A-10. It was either Blair. Yeah, we were blowing up Blair's A-10 on stage, and he had come for that shot, and he took me aside and said, "Look, you know, the end of the film is rather spectacular, and it involves, you know, this tower exploding and this compound being leveled, and you know, it's a really big deal, and we really need your help. Can you guys pull it off?" And I was, "Absolutely. Are you kidding? This is fantastic. It's a good news." He said, "The only hitch is, you know, we really need this in, you know, like 6 or 8 weeks." And it was, you know, a big gulp moment on my part. I kind of stood there and said, "Okay, yeah, let's do it." So, you know, we were actually given a tremendous amount of creative freedom to come up with the look of those shots. There was a whole lot of faith given to us by Charlie Gibson and Ben Snow to come up with something that was going to work and be spectacular. And you know, through a lot of basic description, Christian Altman at ILM worked with us. They were very gracious in saying, you know, "We would love to design a build that's just incredibly futuristic looking thing with compound shapes all over it and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, we understand the time constraints, so you tell us what we can actually do." It was largely designed around what could be done, you know, for the proper budget and the sort of short period of time that we had to do that.
Well, now, let me ask you a question about that, because one of the things that I think is really characteristic about that explosion is, firstly, there's a sense of flaws blowing up, a real sense of flaws,
yep,
which is also mirrored in the fact, as was the case of nuclear blasts we've seen, that the steel underlying structure tends to remain like a skeleton.
That's right.
And we all know that because we've all seen Hiroshima and stuff. And
right.
So not only were you blowing this stuff apart with what was obviously a pretty spectacular blast, but you needed to leave the skeleton there without it being destroyed.
Right.
And the second point that I think is really characteristic is the windows, because when the bottom blast goes out, the top windows don't all just fall out of the building, nor do they all shatter and disappear. Though as the blast gets up, nor do they just separate as one big unit. They do actually fracture. So could you talk to that kind of detailing?
Absolutely. So once we got the building designed, we were going back to the building design, and only because it leads to how we constructed it, we were careful not to include a whole lot of big curves and big shapes. And the reason for it was that we really wanted to build this entire structure out of glass. So everything you see that looks like concrete surfaces, there is a lot of glass in the building, but everything you see that looks like, solid surfaces is basically painted glass.
Wow.
So what we did was we designed the thing in CAD, and we laser cut acrylic, which was basically the outer portion of the building, and then we attached glass to every surface of this building. So the entire building was glass, with the exception of the lower refinery aspects of it, which is the very first shot you see. We constructed those slightly differently. What then we did was we built the skeleton, and to be totally honest, the skeleton we would have liked to have been able to blow a little bit more of that away. In the end, it worked out really well to leave steel structure standing there visually. It worked out really well, but the steel structure was constructed, and then the entire building was clad in glass and acrylic, definitely materials that are going to come apart easily. The key to it, though, was the mortar tree that was in the very center of the building, going from ground level all the way to the top, which had mortars in a circular pattern all the way around a post and spaced not quite one floor apart, but maybe two or three floors apart. They were small, like maybe small two to three inch mortars that were, sort of fanned around this post, and then another, 6 inches above that, another set of them fanned around this post 6 inches up, and all the way up the mortar tree were these mortars. I can't remember the number, but it was in the like 60 to 70 mortars to achieve the look of this thing going, from ground all the way up to the top. The mortars then were very, very close to the glass surfaces. They weren't pushed way back. It was a pretty tight environment for these mortars and the building and everything. So it was rather packed with pyrotechnics and some debris and some stuff in the windows that gave it, a little bit of indication that there's something going on inside this building. It's not just this big blue glowing, post. So we worked hard to break those things up. We also put a tremendous amount of lighting actually on the mortar tree, which was a very scary situation, because we had massive voltage for the lighting going up, and the mortars are activated through electricity. So it was a little nerve-wracking at times, saying, okay, let's turn on the lights, and knowing that we, had this heat and electricity around zip cord that's actually firing the mortars as they went up. But the mortars, when they fired in sequence from bottom to top, and they basically just were so powerful, and so they had so much energy that the blast was able to basically shear off those levels. As you see, it looked like floors blowing up, and that's because the energy was basically just cutting the glass and blowing those sections of glass out as it went up. If you look carefully at the top of the building as the building is blowing up, you can see a little bit of wiggling going on, where the glass is experiencing the energy up at the top, but the fire and the pyrotechnics haven't gotten there yet.
Because I think what sells it, speaking as an amateur looking in from the outside, is there is just no one large piece of shrapnel that debris. It's not like you get anything that seems larger than a shard, as it were.
Right.
And so it just gives it such immense scale.
Well, that was the thing. You know, 24th scale for a skyscraper tower like that that's blowing up is not really the right scale. You know, it was a challenge because, you know, typically we like to be much larger for things like that. So we had to reverse engineer those thoughts. You have to think, okay, this is as big a building as I can make in the time with the budget and blah, blah, blah. And so now what are we going to do to give it scale? So all of the materials were thin, and thin glass and thin acrylic and, you know, little tiny bits. There's some fantastic, you can see some fantastic moments if you're not just focusing on the blue fire as it's roiling around this skeleton and you look out at what's happened, you can actually see all that glass twinkling and falling through the air. You know, you're right. It's rather magical and it has a fantastic look.
I'm just curious. I'm sorry. But I mean, when you say you sort of think of this stuff through, I mean, so is this like a process where you deliberately allow time to get a group in a room and brainstorm, or is it more like you get the problem and you let people mull over it for a bit and then you all come together with your solutions to the problem? I mean, what's the workflow?
No, it's not something that we've done before. I think it's a familiarity with materials. You know, the work process is basically, you know, Nick Dabo, the model supervisor, and myself along with Jeff Herron, starts off with a conference call with Charlie and Ben, and their desires are expressed, and we take notes. We go back and listen to what they've said. We go back and look at our notes, and we say, okay, these are things that need to happen. How will this happen? You know, and those ideas, you know, like I said, you just kind of have to reverse engineer, because if you say, okay, we're going to build this, you know, you can look at traditional model making. Okay, you're going to build this building, and it's going to be out of acrylic, and you're going to use acrylic windows, plexiglass windows, and we're going to put pyrotechnics and we're going to blow these windows out. No, that's, you know, I can tell you right now, we're having that conversation and the answer immediately is, no, that's not going to work. Okay, what's going to blow up that looks like it's going to have the right scale? It's going to do what we want it to do. Oh, well, glass. Okay, glass. All right, so now you're onto something. You know, and it just kind of comes to us that way. And, you know, we do some testing. We'll put together some panels. We may order a couple of different thicknesses of glass and hand them over to Jeff and let him, you know, blow some mortars through them and see what they do. You know, like I said, we'll do it with video. We'll float it, slow down the frame rate, and we'll see what it's doing. It's really important to us to see, you know, we can't see what something is, something like that, what's happening with something like that with the naked eye. All right. Things like that happen at, you know, 320 frames per second. So it's important for us to, you know, theoretically come up with the concepts, execute a couple of tests, adjust the frame rate so we can sort of see what's happening, and then you know, like I said, we take big leaps of faith around here and go for it, and in this case we hit a home run.
Well, look, I so appreciate you giving us the time to talk about this, because it really is impressive.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I want to thank Brian Ganand and, of course, Ben Snow from ILM. That's it for this week here from the FX Podcast. Of course, you can check out all the stories over at fxguide.com or follow us on Twitter, where Jeff is Neon Marg, John is John Mont FX, and I'm Mike Seymour. Next week on the show, we have a really interesting program looking at the outreach program from SIDGRAPH 2009 in New Orleans. Until then, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.